Well, I really am a fan of Einstein's comments about the difference between what he called a theory of wood and a theory of marble. And a theory of wood, if you can imagine somebody taking a bunch of wooden boards and nailing them together to try to make a sculpture, and it's rickety and it teeter-totters a lot. Whereas a really good theory is like it carved out of marble, and it's already there, and you just have to take away that which you don't need. You can't just crash the gate because it can be very damaging. Your shadow self is what you have to move through to get to the fruits of the higher self. I believe that everyone here at this time is awakening to their higher self and their potential. And the idea of a singular messianic figure is very old world patriarchal thinking. So you have the two primal forces in the universe, love and light. Love is fourth density, light or wisdom is fifth density. The unity of love and light is sixth density, the brow chakra. You reach a point in your cosmic evolution where God is not something out there that you're saying, oh, there it is. It's within. So how could you be a messiah on a planet? How could anybody be? Because that implies that it's somebody else. We were building up to a point last time, right before we cut off the camera, and I wanted to finish that point because it is important, and for people who are watching it all edited together, it's going to be kind of a cliffhanger otherwise. I was talking about how the DNA molecule, as per Dr. Peter Gariev's information, acts as an antenna, and that it harnesses photons of light in an otherwise dark room, and all the light will spiral through the molecule. This then lended itself to another Gariev study that he did, where he took a salamander embryo and zapped it with a laser beam, and then was able to redirect the light from the salamander's embryo into a frog embryo. And in so doing, he was able to cause the frog embryo to completely metamorphosize into a salamander. So the relevance of this to what we're talking about is, insofar as we have this interplanetary climate change phenomenon, we have a great outside source of energy that seems to be coming into our solar system and causing changes that we hadn't seen before. And these changes actually affect our DNA. So in other words, when you're seeing the planets change and you're seeing the magnetic fields getting larger, you're seeing the actual atmospheres of the planets becoming brighter, all these things are happening. We are also on the planets. Of course, we're on the Earth, and so the changes are energetic, and it affects the whole system, not just one part of the system. So we are part of that Earth system. So this is really kind of the smoking gun that suggests that that species evolution is actually occurring, and that's part of what this 2012 situation is really about. There is a scientist from UC Berkeley, Dr. Robert Rohde, spelled R-O-H-D-E, and he showed that the evolutionary record does not indicate Darwinian evolution, which occurs at this gradual speed. You have these sudden moments in which new species appear on the Earth, and they occur in even cycles of time, which are actually 62 million years in length. So what that appears to indicate is that there are domains of energy in the galaxy that take us 62 million years to traverse. And when we hit a wave front, when we hit a new layer of this energy, it has an effect on the DNA of every organism on the planet, causing these discontinuous changes, similar to what you saw with the salamander frog experiment.
Would you also say that this facilitates Lamarckian evolution, the inherited of acquired characteristics?
Yeah, insofar as it seems that the energy field that we're interacting with itself is a conscious source, and given the fact that the field itself is conscious, events that cause great stress or pain to an organism are uploaded into the collective mind of that species field, which Dr. Rupert Sheldrake calls them morphogenetic fields. So then what happens is there is an adaptive mutation that occurs based on the needs of that particular species in its environment. The core of what Sheldrake is coming out with in my mind, is most easily seen with the Baxter studies, Dr. Cleve Baxter. Now, last year we actually went down to San Diego and filmed Dr. Baxter. He is a scientist who started out as a CIA polygraph expert. And he decided one day what would happen if I took my polygraph and hooked it up to the leaf of this plant. Well, he was very surprised because unlike a smooth, unchanging wavelength, which he thought he would see from the plant, instead he ended up with a shifting dynamic wave, which was much more indicative of what you would expect a human being to be like, with the exception that the skin kind of acts as a dampening agent to the electrical current. But the plant has a very active dynamic electrical current. Well, then he said, since this plant is acting so much like a human being, what if I ran the plant through stress, similar to how you do a human on a lie detector? The whole purpose of lie detection is you want to get the person into this moment when you say, did you fire the shot who killed so-and-so? And the person has a shock. They're not happy. They're not enthusiastic about your question. So then they end up saying, no, of course I didn't kill him. And then the graph goes crazy. So he says, well, how do I shock a plant? He tried dipping one of the leaves in his coffee. That didn't work. He tried a variety of little things like that. When he got the idea in his mind, without actually even doing it, but just got the idea of going and taking a match, lighting the match, striking it, and then holding it to one of the leaves and burning the leaf, the plant had an enormous reaction. And in fact, it did not stop until after he had actually gone and done it, burned the leaf, and then taken the matches out of the room again. Only once the threat was gone and he was out of the room did the plant finally calm down. So here we are, literally 40 years later after he discovered this, we're filming Dr. Baxter, and he's not an actor. So if we didn't get the plant to have an authentic reaction in our film shoot, then, you know, we weren't going to get him reacting the way that it should be. So we had set up this scene where there was supposed to be a kid in the classroom who hears about Baxter's effect and gets excited and wants to burn the plant to prove it for himself. And we actually had a plant hooked up to the polygraph, and we have a graph of it and everything. And in between takes, it was very tense on set. We were under a very tight time schedule, and there was a problem with this little camera that we had over the polygraph that was supposed to be able to show us the needle's movement, and it wasn't working. And our director was getting really angry at the guy who was trying to set up the camera because it wasn't working. And I noticed that as the tension in the room got really extreme from this camera problem, that the plant was having a very strong reaction. I'm watching the needle going like this. I'm like, wow. This, you know, I mean, I knew it was real, but still, when you see it yourself, it's kind of like the difference between somebody believing in UFOs and somebody seeing a UFO land in your backyard. It was like, okay, that's really happening. So now we have the situation where Baxter is there, and he's not reading lines. He's basically just improvising, which created a lot of trouble in the editing room. And we needed to get the plant to react in a way that was authentic. So I finally got this idea in my mind that I would, at the exact moment in the scene where the kid gets up out of the chair and is going to threaten to burn the plant, my part in that scene is that I'm supposed to try to stop him. I put my hand on his chest and basically push him back. And I said, I'm just going to conjure up the ugliest, darkest, most vile, heinous, horrible emotions that I can think of and just focus them all on that plant. Just and I didn't want to have it show on my face because it wouldn't be appropriate for the shot. But I wanted to get like nervous and have my heart suddenly race. And so we did the shot. The kid gets up to light the plant on fire, and I just blasted this plant with this bolt of very nasty energy, and the plant went crazy. And, Baxter is like, whoa, we got a reaction there. And that was so gratifying because it proved that this is real. Now, the reason why I'm telling you this story is because Baxter proved this not just with plants. He proved it with bacteria. He proved it with single cells. He proved it with human cells. Dr. Brian O'Leary, NASA astronaut, actually gave him a skin sample from the inside of his mouth, and they put it in a tiny little test tube with gold wires, and then sent O'Leary off to the airport. And O'Leary, they synchronized watches, and O'Leary would write down every time something stressful happened to him, like, oh my God, I missed my turn on the thruway or the freeway or wherever. I guess it would have been the freeway because this was California. Thruway is an upstate New York thing. So anyway, O'Leary is writing down every time that he has a stressful event. Well, sure enough, here's his living cells 300 miles away in the lab, and every single time he had a stressful event, his cells were showing a reaction. So then you have to ask yourself, okay, well, what happens if two people's cells come together to make a child? Like the parent-child psychic connection, right? Then you say, well, okay, is it only cells that are from your own body or near to your own body? We actually know that it's not that way. Plants respond to other organisms dying. They don't just respond to threats of their own. You can get a plant to respond to the death of brine shrimp. That was one of Baxter's famous experiments, where he randomly dumped brine shrimp, living brine shrimp, into boiling water, and it would kill them. And as long as nobody else was in the building, the plant would react to the death of the shrimp.
So where are you going with this?
The fact is that when we're seeing evolution occur in these 62 million year periods, it's a function of the actual field of consciousness itself changing. In other words, biology is affected by the field, the way we think is affected by the field, and now that we're heading towards 2012, it's not so much that time is speeding up where you're going to look at a clock and the hands are going to move faster. In a Newtonian model, you have particles that are sitting there in empty space, and they shouldn't have any interaction with each other. Yet when we are in alignment, when we're aligned with the galactic center, so that if you're standing on the Earth and the Earth is rotating and your body is on the surface of the Earth, and as the Earth spins, your position of the galactic center spins, and if there's the galactic center, as I turn and face it, my psychic ability increases so much. It's like there's this river of energy coming from the center of the galaxy. So what that ultimately suggests is that our position in the galaxy does have an effect on our cognitive function, on our thinking. It also gives a strong support to this idea that evolution could be created as a result of a position in the galaxy. Why do you have these 62 million year cycles? In order to really understand how this science works, you have to think in terms of fractals. And what fractal means is that it's actually a term derived from taking an imaginary number, which is the square root of negative 1, and chunking it through a very simple operation, a little equation. And then you take the product of that, and you run it through again, and you take the product, and you run it through again. So if you've ever seen like a paisley shirt, and it has these kind of flowering patterns, that's what the fractal pattern basically looks like. Now, the thing about a fractal is that you can zoom in on it, and the farther in you go, you keep seeing the same pattern appear again.
Like the Mandelbrot set.
Like the Mandelbrot set, exactly. Now, a lot of the crop formations have had fractal patterns. Actually, there was a very interesting case where a team of crop circle researchers was saying, wouldn't it be interesting if the Mandelbrot set showed up in the crops, and the next day it was there. So that was obviously pretty amazing. The fractal principle is important because you have an energy system within an atom, which in some degree is similar to the energy system within the solar system, which in some degree is similar to the energy system within the galaxy. And even the galaxies all have an orbit around a universal center as well. And that has been determined by research from Russia by Dr. A.M. Mishin, M-I-S-H-I-N. So in the solar system, there is a cycle that at first was believed to only affect the Earth. It's a slow wobbling of the Earth's axis called precession. It takes 26,000 years to complete, roughly speaking. The idea being that these walls of energy expand away from the center of the galaxy like ripples on a pond, and there is a discrete boundary like oil and water that we hit in 2012. And that's the most basic level of the model. Now, when you want to go into more detail, it gets into the work of one scientist named Dr. Oliver Crane. He wrote a paper called Central Oscillator and Space-Time Quantum Medium, which is a very scientific-sounding word. But central oscillator means that you have a little pulsation, and you have these toroids. The torus shape is a sphere with a donut hole in the middle. And you have to imagine now that there's an energy flow going through that torus, and it goes through the center. And at the center, there's colliding pressure, which causes there to be a sphere in the center. The pressure increases on the sphere collapses down in size, but then it's like a piston. There's an explosion from the energy coming together, and the explosion blasts it back to its normal size. Then the pressure collapses it again. In the collapse, it creates a surge of energy which explodes it, and it comes back. So you get the idea now how there could be like a rhythm, like a pulse, okay? Well, that's what happens. There's this pulsation at the center of every torus. And that pulsation then ripples out through the medium, because this whole torus is like a fluid. It's like a medium. So the pulses are going out from the center. They reflect off the outside edge of the sphere, okay? And then they start going back towards the center. So they're going out and coming back. So you have this area in the center which is doing this, right? Then you have waves going out, waves reflecting off the edge, waves coming back to the center. So this is what's happening. Now, the waves that go out and the waves that come back are interfering with each other. They collide with each other. When they do, they form walls, spherical walls of energy, where there's a higher concentration, because you got the wave that's coming, you got the wave that's going, and they collide together and they form this wall. Now, as more energy gets into the system, the central oscillator starts going a little bit faster, or maybe the rhythm doesn't change, but the power of the waves change, and so the actual size of the whole system gets larger. And this is what's actually happening. It's basically a counter-rotating energy force. The way that you have one, this actually goes back to the ancient Vedic scriptures from India. They talk about Purusha and Prakriti, the two primeval forces, which actually are geometries. Purusha is a icosahedron, Prakriti is a dodecahedron, which are these basic geometries, the Platonic solids as they're called. So one basically stays stationary and the other one moves, and they counter-rotate inside of each other. So you now have to imagine two spheres with the donut hole in the same space, and as they collide, they counter-rotate, and they form one as it rotates, forms a wave that's going up like this. The other one as it rotates form a wave that goes down like this. The up-going wave and the down-going wave collide in the center, form the sphere. That pressure creates the pulsation. The pulsation creates ripples that go out. Ripples come back. They interfere with each other. They create these walls of energy. And as the system evolves, the walls of energy push away from the center and they grow and expand in size. As those walls collide with our solar system, they charge up the sun. They charge up the planets. That's what we're seeing in my work with Hoagland. It affects the whole solar system. It changes our DNA. It expands our consciousness. And it ultimately changes the frequency of physical matter, leading to a complete transmutation effect similar to the Bermuda Triangle, except that it's now the whole planet. So you have people basically disappearing, and this ties back in with the Christian rapture idea and all the other systems of thought that have the same thing.
One of the questions I asked was whether this synthesis in your understanding is known and fully understood and utilized by the powers that be, whoever you consider the powers that be to be.
Well, I certainly don't want to come across as a know-it-all or arrogant or whatever. What I can say is that this is not my information that I'm sharing with you as much as it is information that I was shown through what you could call remote viewing or telepathy. And it was only because I had the scientific context and background to be able to understand what I was actually being shown and then find the research for it. The black ops community has a fairly good knowledge of physics, but it does not have a complete knowledge of physics, and it does not really fully understand what it's seeing. It has long been a surprise to me the lack of knowledge on behalf of individual members, whistleblowers within that community. And I think part of that is, as we were saying off camera, that severe compartmentalization makes it so that information that's known to one guy in one desk of the CIA is not known to the next guy in the next desk. And I actually met with a retired CIA officer who confirmed that to me.
And it's the same with the scientists. The guy in Livermore doesn't know what the guy in Los Alamos is doing. And sometimes even when they're told to share information, they don't even do that.
So what you end up having, like in quantum mechanics, there are so many competing models to try to explain the basics of quantum mechanics. Superstring theory, 11 dimensions, 26 dimensions, 9 dimensions, Kaluza-Klein theory, which is a five-dimensional universe. And the mathematics are so complex that you can't learn all of it. You can only learn one very specialized area. Well, I really am a fan of Einstein's comments about the difference between what he called a theory of wood and a theory of marble. And a theory of wood, if you can imagine somebody taking a bunch of wooden boards and nailing them together to try to make a sculpture, and it's rickety and it teeter-totters a lot. Whereas a really good theory is like it carved out of marble, and it's already there, and you just have to take away that which you don't need. Einstein said that a really good theory is self-evident. It's simple, it's easy, you can explain it, and it works. We're now dealing with a unified science in which we see the same properties at the quantum level as we see at the galactic level, the micro and the macro, and in mainstream science, quantum physics and relativity theory, which is Einstein's physics, do not interrelate with each other. There's a very big disconnect there. Unified field theory is going to have to unify those together, and I believe that what I'm describing to you is a unified theory. Part of that is how we see the same effects in the quantum field showing up in the structure of these superclusters of galaxies, where they're all based on this octahedron shape, like an egg carton. They call it an egg carton universe. That's Batana and Florido. Those two scientists in Spain did that research. So I don't want to get too far off track into physics things, because a lot of people start, you know, when you do this on stage, you see the heads start going like this.